As part of the Scottish FA's ongoing coach education activities, Jack Ross, Brian Rice and Robbie Nielsen joined myself, Greg Patterson and a number of our UEFA A-licensed students for a live question and answer session. We join this session with Brian Rice explaining how he has found working from home during the coronavirus pandemic.
You know, a lot is we're all furloughed at the club, so there's no real contact regarding training or working. You know, I phone them to make sure their families are okay, they're okay, do they need anything on a personal level. Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's good, you need to keep relationships going. And it's all done, obviously, through our laptops and all these devices we've got. But it's been challenging. I think the good weather helped us all. We all got our gardening done and whatever. But I think as it's progressed, then it's got more and more difficult. And I think we're all looking forward now and getting back to work.
Yeah. Yeah. Jack, signs that we are now getting back to work, certainly in the Premier League for you guys anyway.
Yeah, obviously I know there's a couple of clubs returned already. Robbie and I are returning Monday, Brian's a little bit later. Initially, still very different to what we would normally do because of some of the guidelines that we have to adhere to in terms of social distancing within training. But be nice to nice to get back coaching, nice to get back in contact with players. And I think, you know, Brian's touched on a lot of the challenges for managers and coaches through this period. But one of the things that maybe people don't take into account is that although, and I know there'll be a bit, there's probably be questions in this, there's pressures with the job and there's demands of the job, is ultimately we do this job because we love the excitement you get from it. And when you don't have matches and you're not working with your player on a daily basis, you don't have that. So that's a, I think for all of us, that's a big miss because we've been used to having it now for a prolonged period.
Mm-hmm. That sense of community, Robbie, is something you've probably missed over the last 12 weeks as well.
Yeah, I think it's been difficult to communicate with players. You know, initially we were unsure when we were going to start back, so we gave them a bit of time off, and then we started to build up again. But it was the communication thing was a big part of it because we at St Andrews and were quite tightly grouped together, but we didn't have that contact, so we had to start using Zoom. We were speaking in the mornings we quite regularly with them just to see how they are, their mental health and how their families are. And then we decided to split the senior players into groups so they would each look after five or six players each. So contact them two or three times a week and then feed back to us as a staff. So I feel it's been quite beneficial in building the team and also building that leadership group. They've really come to the fore in the last probably couple of months while we've been in this situation.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, Brian, that Robbie makes. You know, that when the COVID first kicked in, I think it was Friday the 13th, funnily enough, wasn't it, when we stopped football in Scotland? But, you know, looking back on that, you were probably planning for the following week or even 2 weeks ahead, and then it's just been changing all the time. So it's a difficult one for you as a manager to plan and prepare.
Yeah, well, we were planning to go to Ross County, travel up to Ross County on the Friday afternoon, and everything got stopped on Friday morning. So we'd done all our preparation with all our plans set in motion for the next two games. So it's been very, very difficult. You know, it really has been difficult to plan. Everything you had planned and all your expectations, you know, we were going to be in the bottom six, looking at who we were going to be playing against, our points target, whatever we were looking at, everything just went up in the air. And Robbie and Jack's right. It's the uncertainty in knowing what's next because the start date may be changed. My training date's been changed three times when I'm going back, and it's a challenge to try to keep the players fit on their own and the condition to come back in before you can really start pre-season again.
Yeah, it's interesting. People talk about change management, don't they? But everything's just constantly changing at this point in time. So, Jack, you picked up on pressure, and in fact, a couple of people have asked about pressure. Andy Gardner's got a question. We'll maybe kick off with questions now. And Andy's asked, how do you deal with pressure from maybe fans in the media? A rueful smile.
Well, I think you have to. I think Robbie and Brian will come in, but I think you have to learn to do so. Because I think if you want to progress to that level in your career within coaching, and you want to be a head coach or a manager, you have to acknowledge that it's going to be there. And it's, you know, I've spent this time listening to other webinars and hearing or the manager speaking, I think one of the things that maybe the more experienced managers do acknowledge is that the pressures have arguably grown now in the modern game just because of the way in which opinion can be expressed. You know, it's 24/7 coverage. The mediums in which people can express their opinion are far more wide-ranging. So, impossible to escape from the pressure. So then if you acknowledge that, then I think it's how you deal with it. You have to find a manner of escapism, at times, Greg, from it. And that's not easy because the job is all-consuming as well. But I think you have to train yourself to do so. Now, each and every person will have their own way of doing that, whether they have a hobby that they can throw themselves into, whether they read, whether it's spending time with family. And I think experience does teach you that you recognise the times where perhaps you have to switch off from it. I've probably got better at putting my phone down and or switching it off or putting it in a drawer for certain periods through an evening, because I think if you don't, then you would find yourself being dominated by it all the time, and you absolutely need the break from it. But you have to find some sort of coping mechanism. For me, you know, having two daughters, it's probably the natural thing to do is allow them to provide an escape from sometimes the pressures.
Listening to the likes of Steve Salas and Don McNaughton on the courses over the last couple of weeks, Robbie, they talk a lot about, you know, you can't pick up a book and learn about resilience, as Jack's alluded to there. How do you go about switching off, and is it just about managing your time better, as Jack says?
I think that the big thing about pressure for me is like trying to realise that, you know, what is pressure? Pressure is something you put on yourself. You know, it's not an actual physical thing. So for me, it's, you know, the pressure is an external thing that people talk about, but it's an internal thing you feel. So if you can, what I always try and be is do my work to the best of my ability, be as prepared as we can be as a team and as a staff. And then you have to accept that what will be on a Saturday will be. You can do all the prep you want. You can have it absolutely nailed on, and in the first minute your centre-half gets sent off and it's out with their control, and it's just about dealing off the back of that. So I think you have to realise that people talk about pressure in football, but really it's nothing, you know. It's football. It's a big game of people making mistakes. So you're going to win, you're going to lose. And I've always felt like that, and I've always felt that it's good to realise that. Do the work properly. Be on it 100%, give everything you can, and then on a Saturday, you know, things can happen and it can change. It's a random game. And as for, you know, a release from the pressure, I've always felt that for me, being on the training field is a release, because you don't have the external factors as a manager. You know, you don't have to go and speak to the press after it. You don't have to deal with the nonsense in the background, the agents, you know, the owners and the issues. When you're out there and you're enjoying it and you're on the grass, is what we all want to do. And that's probably the difference between an assistant manager or a coach and the manager. They don't have that once they come off the training field.
Yeah. Brian, you've a huge experience, as Robbie says there, as being an assistant manager before, you know, you took the reins at Hamilton. Is there a difference in the pressure that you feel?
Yeah, well, I was assistant manager for about 22 years before I went into being a manager or head coach. There is a difference depending on who's leading the team at the time. I was very fortunate that when I worked with John Hughes, that he let me be sort of like a co-manager, although he was manager in title. So I learned lots from the manager, but I've been at other clubs where I have been an assistant manager, and it is different. You know, the pressure on the assistant manager is nowhere near as much as it is in the manager, because we don't have to face the press, we don't have to face the media much. All that's on the head coach or the manager. But, you know, we've all got our personal pride. We've all got things like that. And I think pressure is at different levels. My pressure on my club or on me at my club will be different from, say, Jack at his club, where he's at a big club. My level of pressure is to keep my team in the Premier League and try and produce young players to sell on. But I'm quite fortunate that, you know, my hobby is football. My release to getting away is going to games and watching games. That's just the way I am. You know, football's been my life for over 40 odd years. I love getting away to watch a game. That relaxes me. That really relaxes me. So as much as it's my job, it's also my hobby.
Yeah, fantastic. And it maybe brings me on to a question Matt Williams asked. He's asking there, have you ever kind of looked back, Brian, and recognised where you made bad decisions, or any examples where bad decisions were made as a management team, perhaps because of the pressure you were under at the time, maybe even as you're progressing in cups as you've done and went, you know, that way?
Yeah, I mean, you make mistakes every day. You make mistakes every Saturday. And it's trying to cut down on those mistakes. Because I believe that you'll only learn by making mistakes. I don't think making mistakes is the biggest regret you'll ever have. I think you need to make mistakes to learn. I'm a great believer in that. I can remember us playing a cup quarter final, and we left our best player out because we wanted to rest him for the Saturday. You know, and it's something I would never do again. I would put my strongest team out every time that I'm playing, because as a manager, you want to win games and you get judged by your results. You do get judged by your results, you know, not the way you play. When it comes Monday morning, all people are talking about are the results. So, like I said, we've changed teams at times to try and rest players and things like this. I would always try and start with my strongest team. And that's one regret that when I was younger, I didn't really appreciate it. I just thought that you could chop and change all the time. And I don't think you can do that at our level.
Yeah. Jack and Robbie, I'm not sure who to go to next. You two, I've been fortunate enough to listen to you two do webinars and presentations on our recent pro license group. And the two of you have been very open and honest in admitting, I suppose, mistakes that you've made all the way. You know, losing jobs and having to bounce back. So, I don't know, Robbie, do you maybe want to pick that up? The importance of making mistakes, as Brian says.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, for me, the biggest mistake you can make is not to make a decision. You know, I've been with, you know, worked with managers before, or under managers as a coach and a player, where they can't make a decision. You know, for me, being a manager is about making decisions. And sometimes that decision might be, I'm not going to make a decision for 5-10 minutes within the game, but you've got to make these decisions. And it's also taking yourself out the bubble of being involved in the game at times can be difficult. You know, I've found that it's quite a hard thing, especially when you play in big environments and big crowds. You can get caught up in the game, and it's how you come out of that. But yeah, I've probably learned that as I went along. I think made a lot of mistakes like we all do, you know, whether it be as a player, a young coach, or down to a manager. But for me, it's a lot is about trying to learn from it and reflect on it. Something I've tried to do a lot more recently, spending a bit of time thinking about what I did, and not just what I did and how it affected me, but how it affected the team. You know, how you've maybe reacted to a defeat in the moment, and really has it been a beneficial to me? Well, it's maybe been a hindrance to the team. You know, so really, after the games now, I'll try. I know it's easier said than done, because sometimes you get caught up in the moment, but yes. Try to compose myself so that when I speak to the team or the players or even the media, I'm looking at the next game and how I can influence what I say and what I do and how I carry myself from that moment to the next one. Whereas when I was a younger coach and a younger manager, I would react a lot quicker, you know, and looking back in hindsight, having done it, I'm going, that was not the right thing to do, because it affected the team negatively. Might have helped me and made me feel better, but ultimately it's about making the team feel better and getting a performance the following Saturday. So, yeah, I made a lot of mistakes like that, thinking that it's about reacting, and a lot of the time it's about, you know, what's good for the team might not be good for me.
Yeah. Jack, I know you're big on reflection. As I said, been fortunate enough to sit in some of the webinars you've maybe done recently, and you know, you go right back to your days as a Hearts under 20 coach and go through that journey of reflection and where you've made mistakes and how that's allowed you to grow, though, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, I think as Robbie's mentioned there, that I think the ability to self-reflect is huge. You, of course, walk that fine line between self-reflection and being overly critical of what you do or questioning too much what you do. I think that's the balance to make, because self-reflection is incredibly healthy, and I've found it very useful. I think it tips slightly beyond that you start to probably maybe question too much your methods. And in terms of touching on mistakes, I think one of my biggest learning curves from my time at Sunderland was probably how my decision making, not necessarily in picking teams, but I think I had, you know, when I was at other clubs and probably like a lot of people have an ambition to progress up the ladder. So a lot of my decision making was ambition led. Whereas when I found myself at this big club, I didn't want to lose that. I didn't want to not be at that club. And of course, I think then what it does is it can make your decision making fear based rather than ambition based. And that's I think something I became conscious of. And I said, I'm not relating that to team selection. I think it was more just about, as Robbie's touched on, you make a heck of a lot of decisions as a manager, much about picking teams during games, during the week. And all of a sudden, I maybe questioned my decision-making process more than I had ever done. Because, as I said, you know, you feel as if you've progressed up the ladder and you don't want to lose that. You want to make sure you maintain yourself at that level. But again, reflecting on it, the best way to do that, I think, is probably, if you trust and believe in your methods, is to keep doing that.
And amongst all these mistakes, Chipper, you've got to educate yourself, and I know you're big on that. You're the first to put your hand up every year to help out on B licences and A licences with us, which is fantastic. So how do you go about, you've mentioned earlier, you like to go and watch a lot of games. How else do you educate yourself? What do you read? What do you watch? This is a question from Gavin McLeod.
Yeah, I read a lot. When I go on holiday, I read in my spare time. I'm very big on the mindset. I'm very big on the mindset. It's fine. My own mindset, first and foremost, because I believe if my mindset isn't right, then how can I expect my team's mindset to be right? And my team behind the team, as we spoke about. Mm-hmm. I like reading about other sports. You know, Sam Allardyce was great. He was the first one I heard talking about having specific coaches for specific areas in the team, striker coaches, defensive coaches, set play experts. He was one of the first many years ago I heard talk about that, and he got that for the American football system. I'm really big on that and reading, and I watch a lot of football. You know, I don't watch a lot of my own teams playing. I don't go over video after video after video. You know, I maybe pick out two or three games and why were we doing things well there and we weren't doing them so well in the next couple of games, things like that. I'm the first person to pick up the phone and ask questions to somebody, a manager of work with people I respect. I'm not scared to ask for help. You know, I want to learn. I want to get better every day. You know, I've got to keep improving. The world doesn't stand still. That's why I love coming on the courses and that. I've picked up so much coming in the courses for the candidates, just picking out their sessions and adapting it to what I need. So I think you've got to just keep learning, and any tool that you can use to get better, then you've got to use it.
Mm-hmm. Robbie, Brian maybe touched on maybe having a mentor there. Is that something you would consider or advise young coaches to do, is to get a mentor?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have somebody that you can go and speak to, whether it be in football or even out of football. You know, I speak quite regularly to Alex Smith over in Australia now. Alex, for any who don't know him, is the kind of godfather of Scottish football and coaching, and was on the licences, taking them for, God, 50-odd years. Alex will be 18 now. So I'll speak to Alex just if there's any issues that come up, and just for a blare. And sometimes it's good just to talk about different things, how the families are doing. You know, somebody that you know you can trust, and you know that you can give information that you maybe wouldn't want to give to other people. You know, there's some stuff that we'll talk about that you don't want to get out to the players or the press or even your own staff at times if you're speaking about them. So it's, I would definitely advise it. It allows you to get advice, but also sometimes just to clear your head a wee bit. You know, it's really, really important.
Yeah. And Jack, what do you do? You spoke earlier about putting the phone in the drawer. Is that a time, is that just a complete and utter switch off time, or is that the time you pick up a book or watch a documentary to do a little bit of learning as well?
Yeah, usually I've got to do the ironing at that point, Greg, and then the hoovering. No, I think, again, the circumstances, probably the job I'm in at the moment, I've got a longer commute to the training ground than I've had in my recent job. So that probably means that that commute allows me to make some of the phone calls and deal with things that I would normally have had to do in the house. So the circumstances sometimes help you do that. But in terms of, I think, I have, when I was at Simon, I was fortunate to come across a guy called Gavin White, who was a non-executive director at the club, but his background is in corporate behavioural work. And so he became, you speak about mentor figures, he became somebody that allowed me to have a much better understanding in my own decision-making process. And I know that, I mean, I'm going off subject slightly, but I know there might be those that will question whether you have a psychologist that works within a football club. And for me, I think the manager or the head coach should be the psychologist, but how do we get as much knowledge as we can to deliver that type of information or deal with the challenges that players have? So he's somebody that I've found from a non-football perspective, if you like, that's helped me immensely with professionally and personally. So when I'm saying about decision-making processes, I'm talking about day-to-day life as well. And then beyond that, in terms of, I've always been interested in people that build their own businesses. I think I'm fortunate enough to have a couple of close friends that have done that and done it really successfully. And the amount of correlation between building a business successfully and managing a football club or leading a football club is exactly the same. People think, you know, football is this unique industry, but there's so many parallels about how you make sure you have happy staff and how you get the best from them.
Yeah, and chatting about staff, there was a lot of questions come in earlier on about staff and how we manage staff. And maybe I'll come back to you. Maybe now, Brian, let's ask you, what traits and characteristics do you look for in an assistant?
First and foremost, I've got to have a good work ethic. I've got to match my work ethic. I've got to be knowledgeable. We've got to be on an understanding that we're on the same wavelength about how we want to play, what our thoughts are in the game, our coaching sessions. It's got to be somebody you can trust. Somebody you can trust 100%, whatever you tell them. You know, somebody that doesn't take things personal. I think that's a thing we miss out a lot on, you know, because there's arguments, we call them heated discussions between the manager and assistant manager. And you're picking teams about training, about certain players. As long as they don't take it personal, you know, I think that's very important. Because at the end of the day, we're all trying to achieve the same thing, success for our club. I think I've got to pick somebody that I know, if I'm not there, if I'm away to watch a player someplace else, I don't need to worry about my training session. I know it's going to be top notch, you know, so I give my assistant a blank piece of paper. This is gone. When you go, come back with ideas. Come back with what we should be doing. Because I keep saying to them, I've not got all the answers. I definitely haven't got all the answers, and I need help. You know, and if I knew it all, I would need somebody, but I don't. So I think your assistant manager and picking your assistant manager is very, very important. And sometimes we get caught up in picking our friends because they'll tell us what we want to hear. You know, they won't tell you, no, by the way, you're wrong, Gaffer, or can we have a word, Gaffer? I think you've made a mistake there. Our friends tend to side with us.
Side with yourself.
Sometimes why they are friends. So I think it's very, very important that you get the right person by your side.
Mm-hmm. Jack, on Monday, Steve Salas, kind of what Brian was saying there, brings me back to what Steve was saying on Monday, and that every expert hires an expert. Is that true, maybe, when you're looking for a good assistant?
Yeah, I think what Steve said is right, because speaking about people that build their own businesses successfully, that's what a lot of these guys do. They end up employing people that are smarter than them because they recognise the importance of doing so. So I think that, I suppose it's about being comfortable enough in your own skin to have people working for you that are talented and can provide benefit. I think, you know, touching on what Brian said and extending it as well is finding people that do not need to be led all the time. You know, I think it's important that assistant manager or coaches have the ability and the want to think for themselves and recognise what things they can do without being prompted to take away from your potential workload or some of the challenges that you face. And that's a skill in itself. But then I think that you know, everybody will have their own way of building their staff, but I think the dynamics in terms of the characters that are involved in your staff as well, I think it's important that you don't build a staff that are all of the same type in terms of their personalities. You know, that mix that you have between introverts and extroverts and personalities, etc., I think is vital within your backroom staff as well.
Yeah. Working on initiative, Robbie, is an important one for your assistants and your backroom team, isn't it?
Sorry, what's that? Sorry?
Working an initiative, allowing them to work on their own initiative and having that trust, just as the guys were saying.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think one of the big things is delegating. I think Steve spoke about it the last few days over the week. It's a big, big thing that I've felt I've improved in and tried to improve in, because you're bringing in high-level coaches, and it's important you give them the freedom to go and put sessions on, have an input, you know, take players, have their own ideas, take initiative, put maybe different practices on and lead different areas. It's, you know, I know when I first started managing, I was very much hands-on and I wanted to do everything. And I started to realise that I wasn't allowing my assistants to really coach or lead as much as they want. So over the last kind of few years, I've tried to delegate a lot more, because it's important that you have to develop them as well. You know, your job as a manager, head coach, isn't just to develop your players, you've got to develop your staff, whether that be on pitch or in analysis or recruitment, and try and help them and build that through. And I do think that having a freshness to your coaching staff is very important as well. I think you can get stuck in your ways, put the same sessions on with the same ideas. Like Brian said there, you know, if you employ somebody by your side for the last 5, 10, 15 years, it becomes the same chat you have, the same talk, the same session. So I think it's important to bring that freshness. If you look at Alex Ferguson, changed his assistant manager every 2 or 3 years to bring that freshness to the training. He was always there, the constant, but he was always bringing a new idea to try and keep the training moving forward, new ideas. So I do think there's a time frame where you can keep your assistants, and it's important to develop them so that you hope that they move on to bigger and better things, and then you can backfill off the back end.
Yeah. It leads me on to a question from Dean. Dean asked, do you always try to keep the same assistant? Brian, you've obviously evolved through the years with a few different managers and different things as an assistant and now your own, but what are you thinking on, touching on what Robbie said and maybe Dean's question there about, would you always try and keep the same assistant manager?
Me personally, no, I don't think I would. I think assistant managers should have ambition as well to go on and be a manager someplace else, or to just move on for his own personal development. I think your role, as Robbie says, is right. You're trying to develop these coaches to be the best they can. And I think it's a freshness, as we spoke about. You know, players get bored very, very easily. You know, and having this, hearing the same voices every single day for maybe 5, 6 years, it's very difficult for the players to get motivated. And that's the biggest challenge, is motivating the players. They want them to come into their work and to enjoy the sessions. And the biggest motivation is good sessions and good coaching. You know, it's so important that they enjoy their work. Because I'm a great believer in if you enjoy it, you'll work hard. And if you work hard, you'll enjoy it. It's a wee flip side to me. So there's downsides and there's upsides. You get to know somebody very well. You build up a trust and a relationship with them. And you know you can hang your hat on them. But at the end of the day, you've got to look at the bigger picture. What's the best for my players? And it might not necessarily be best for you as a coach, because you've got used to working with this same person, their methods, their ways. And you may be back at scratch again to build somebody else now, a new relationship. So it's very much an individual thing, but I think it's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm. Jack, you've changed your backroom team maybe through a multitude of reasons between Sunderland and Hibs now, and Brian's right, you've obviously got to build new relationships, although you might have had relationships with some of those people before, but you've got to adapt and build again.
Yeah, and Brian's saying about it's highly unlikely that you'll be able to do that through your whole management career for a number of reasons. One, the opportunities you may get may mean that you go in and you inherit a staff that's already in position. So I think you have to be aware that you need that flexibility. to perhaps work with, you know, you'd be the only person that goes in. My first managerial job, I inherited an assistant, and then from there I've been able to take people with me, but that's changed as well. And I think it's about recognising that are the right people to make you have the best chance of being successful. And it sounds a little bit cold and calculated, yeah, but it's got to be like that, you know, I think. And the challenge of the job maybe determines that. And equally, you may progress to a different challenge and maybe a bigger club and may find out that the dynamics aren't quite the same as they were at a smaller club because of different challenges and people react differently to the different challenges. I think you have to be then aware enough to acknowledge that also. Just one last point, I know that Brian mentioned about you know, assistants progressing into management. The only thing I would say maybe just for some of the guys that are on the course is that, you know, nothing, I don't think there's anything wrong with maybe just being happy as being an assistant manager and being the best one you can be. I think that's something that you probably will find out along the way in your journey, but recognising what your strengths are, and if you can make yourself the absolute best in that, then you're an asset to somebody as well. But yeah, I mean, I think that, come back to Brian touched on the beginning, there's no one size fits all approach to how you have an assistant and how you take them to clubs. Just recognising what gives you the best chance of success, I think, in the job you're in.
Yeah, and I think the message to become the very best you can. I think, Brian, you maybe correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think Parkey, when he worked with his previous, Parkey always used to speak about being the, you know, he didn't really like management that much, but he loved being an assistant. And he spoke about, I think, with a book he used to always quote, was it called The Consigliere or something like that? I think it was an Italian guy. He just spoke about that need and want to be the best possible assistant.
Well, like I touched on earlier, I was an assistant for 22 years and I had the opportunity 4 or 5 times to go in to be a manager. But I was happy in my role. Mm. You know, I looked at the strengths in my role there and I looked at my weaknesses, and the weaknesses that I wrote down wouldn't have made me a good head coach or a manager. You know, I didn't want to work with the media. I didn't want to deal with the board. Things like that. I was quite happy to go in the morning, set up the training sessions, do the tactics, set plays, all that. That was my role and I loved it. But just being on the pitch with the players. Jack was a player of mine. Jack will remember me doing that every day. You know, it was something that I loved. But I got to a stage where I thought, I may never get the chance now.
Give it a bash.
At my age, I might never get a chance to be a head coach. And when I got the opportunity and I decided to grab it, but I think you've got to be the best that you can be. It doesn't matter what role you're at a club. You've got to get everything you've got and have no regrets.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we'll change tact a bit. Thanks, guys. We'll change tact. I've got a question here from James Beater. It'll please Ian Donnelly. What do you look for from your analysis department? I like the ambition he's got there. He's got an analysis department in games, both from your own team and opposition. Robbie, maybe start with you. Are you quite prescriptive in what you look from your analysts?
Yeah, we'll probably... He'll do a presentation for me early in the week about his thoughts on it, and he'll know the way we want to play in the 5 phases of the game. So what the opposition do in their transitions to defence, to attack, in possession, out of possession, we'll do a wee SWOT analysis on it as well, so strengths and weaknesses, and have a look at it, put it up on the board, and then he'll do individual stuff as well. So we'll look at individual players, what their trends are, you know, whether it be a left-sided player that's playing on the right, moving inside, so the threats from that. And then we'll put together a game plan. So he knows how we want to play. He should know how the opposition look to play. And then we get a presentation on it. We'll do all that. I'll watch the games as well. I'll watch 3 or 4 of the opposition games, tag it, send it to him, and then we'll put it all together. So it's quite a long, drawn-out process.
Yeah.
I would say, to be honest, it'll take 20, 30 hours of work to get it down to 16 minutes of clips for the players. Yes. So it's a long drawn out process for both analyst and manager. We're going to try and change it a little bit for the upcoming season, where one of my assistants will join me and the analyst to try and cut the load down so that we're not spending as much time. Last season we also had one of the assistants who focused on the set plays, so that was his sole job, just again to try and cut the time that we're spending watching games down and analysing. So Yeah, it's I would say it's probably the most time-consuming part of my job is analysis for the post-match and pre-match, and it can be, you know, it can be difficult at times watching, especially when you're in the Championship of Scotland, as Brian and Jack will know. It's sometimes they're not the most entertaining or aesthetically pleasing game you will get.
Jack, it must have been tough when you were maybe even down at Sunderland, and Robbie's talking about the amount of time and intensity and putting those presentations together. Your games, I think you're probably weekend, midweek throughout a season. There's not much break down there when you're playing in League One.
Yeah, I know Robbie has had that similar experience when he was at MK Dons, the frequency of the games and how it limits. So it limits your time on the pitch and what you can do on the pitch, and it probably puts a greater significance on your analysis work because the physical demands mean you can be on the pitch less. So we had a 61 game season, the first season down there, so it's a lot of matches, and as Robbie's mentioned, it's the most time consuming aspect of the job. I think one of the keys is the relationship you have with your analysis or your analysis department, the trust you have from them. So within a 61 game season, I had to have trust within my department, because it would have been impossible for me to watch as much footage as maybe I normally would have done. And I was fortunate that I inherited a head analyst at Sunderland who had done it for a number of years, but had also played at a pro level as a young player, and his all-round understanding of the game was very good, and it gave me comfort because I really trusted the information he gave me. Now, I'm not saying that he has to have played the game to develop that trust, but I think the sooner you can build up the trust of an analyst, it makes it more efficient, the work you can do, because as Robbie mentioned, it can be, you know, it can be time consuming. And also, I think this is something that Steve and I were speaking quite a lot about in our tutorial group, is that because there's so much information there, it's trying to be as concise as possible with it. So, you know, Robbie's speaking about the meetings you'll have to try and edit down your package for the players. There's nothing worse as a manager that coming through it being overly excessive, because you know you're going to have to sit and plough through it to narrow it down to what is the important parts for your players. So, I think it's a hugely important part of the modern game. I know the amount we use it has increased greatly. And then the last part is, again, we'd agree with Robbie in terms of the delegation of some aspects of analysis within your staff. So we did the same last year, where my assistant and first team coach dealt with the analysis for set pieces, because they were taking responsibility for them on a match day, and then they then started to lead the meetings for them as well. Which was definitely giving up, not taking the part of the analysis meeting, but I think it worked better as well.
Yeah. Is it becoming a bigger part of the game, Brian, you've noticed? Is it important? I know, you know, Donald McNaughton would talk, I heard Donald talk earlier about, or yesterday, sorry, about, you know, players being more inquisitive these days. Is that the case? And you maybe need to have more evidence because of, or through video analysis?
I think it's expected now. I think players expect it. You know, if you don't do it, then you're doing something wrong. It's now part of your week's planning, and it's massive now compared to what it was before, and it's getting bigger and better all the time with the different tools that you can use. We're very much all the same in the video analysis, strengths and weaknesses, and how teams play, all the patterns they play, things like that. But I think it's Jack touched on it there. It's the attention span of the players. You know, give it down to a time that the players are engaged in it and they can concentrate and take your training from it. One thing I try not to do, if I'm playing a really good team, I try not to scare my players by showing them how good the other team are. I'll show little clips, but I'll try and focus mostly on their weaknesses to say, like, we all know they're a good team, but this is how we can get a chance against them. This is what we can do. Because I don't think there's anything worse and somebody telling you you're playing against a great player today, you're playing against a boy who can run for fun today. I think that's a mindset thing that I'm on about all the time. I'm trying to build my players up, no set them back, you know.
Yeah.
One thing I use my analysis team for a lot is individual work, whether it's one-on-ones or small groups, defenders, midfielders, strikers. and ask questions in these little groups that we have. We maybe show a few clips of Saturday's game, who are defending, and I'll ask them, come on, let's go. And you'll find players will talk in smaller groups better than they will in larger groups.
Yeah.
You know, and I've also found that Jack says there, I don't take it all the time, because sometimes I think, well, the manager's in here, I better watch what I'm saying. I think he'll talk to the assistant manager more freely and more openly. You know, so I try to encourage that with my assistant manager. Go and you take the midfielders today, have a look at a few clips for the last few games and get some feedback. See what they think. I keep saying it. I might think, as Steve said earlier, the answer's eight, but then for them to get to eight, it might be 5 and 3 and 4 and 4. It's not always the same way to get there. They may see things that I don't see. You know, so I think it's vitally important now, video analysis, but you've got to understand it.
Yeah. Question from Paul Hanlon. I'll maybe let you take a breather on this one, Jack, just while you maybe get your head around it. Can you discuss and elaborate on your dealings with the powers above? How do you deal with the CEO? How regular does that happen? How often do they put demands on you, Robbie?
Depends who your CEO is and what your relationship is. It can be difficult. I would say it's probably the most important relationship you'll have at a football club. It's the most important one for a head coach or a manager who's managing up the way and getting that relationship. And I've had some good ones and some bad ones. You know, I think the line of communication is so important. You know, looking back at my time when I was at Hearts, I had a really good line of communication to the sporting director and then to the owner. When I went down to MK, I didn't have a great line of communication into the owner. The CEO was looked after a different part of the club, so it was really me and the owner that communicated. And as results started to wane or get worse, the contact and the line of communication started to dry up, probably from both ends. You know, we were arguing more and I wasn't answering the phone as much, wasn't as open on the phone. And that, what happened with that is that as my communication got less and less into the owner, external communication became more and more into the owner. So he was starting to hear things that maybe I wasn't wanting to hear, or it wasn't the idea of where I was wanting to take the club. So it was a real eye-opener for me. And having left there and moved to Dundee United, I've made sure that my communication with the powers above me have been constant. I'll speak to my sporting director, you know, 2 or 3 times a day at times. Definitely once a day I will speak to him, no matter what we're doing. Even throughout this pandemic, I've been speaking to him every single day. You know, like I said, today I've already spoke to him twice. I think it's so important that you have that line of communication, because when everything's going well, it's fine, but when things are going poorly, you need to have that support from him. You have to understand what he's thinking, and also he has to understand what you're thinking and why you're doing it. Because if you don't, it's the beginning of the end, in my opinion.
Yeah. Brian, you've noticed a difference, obviously, since coming to Hamilton, that difference, if it was maybe Yogi or whoever that was dealing with that kind of stuff first, and now you're in the firing line.
Yeah, it's been a learning curve for me. I think first and foremost, you've got to respect the position that these people hold, you know, and you've got to have a relationship with them. You've got to have an open, transparent relationship with them. But you've got to also remember that everybody's got an opinion. You know, people sitting up in the stand and watching a Saturday or in a boardroom, they've all got their opinion on your best team, on your tactics, on you. So I think that relationship you build up with them, the trust you build up with them, is very, very important. And I think a way to do that, to build this relationship, is to tell them things. No, give them, phone them, let them know what's happening at the club. Let them know what, you know, I've got my this player maybe for 2 months down the line, whatever. Make them feel important. Make them feel part of it. There's nothing worse I've found than directors not knowing or CEOs not knowing something you're doing. Give them bits of information. Make them feel special. Invite them down to the training. Invite them to the training. Come and see the training. This is what we're doing. So when you're watching on a Saturday, you can see exactly what we're working on. You know, it's not just off the cuff. It's things we're actually working on. Come and see the hours the boys put in. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important as well that the players have got, they can engage with them as well. It can't be a them and us. You know, it's everybody together, whatever it takes to get success at your club. I think the relationship between you and the boy above you is really important. But I think the players have got to have that communication as well. No going to them every day, I don't mean that, but being friendly enough with them where everyone's happy.
Jack, Brian's saying there maybe not to go every day, and Robbie's saying maybe speak to, well, certainly one director every, you know, two or three times a day. Where would you sit and try to develop those relationships?
Yeah, it's probably a recurring theme throughout this that I've mentioned about not having a one-size-fits-all approach, and I think that, again, will be determined by the club you're at and the structure it has. So I think, I think Robbie's alluding to the fact he has a sporting director in Tony Ashcar, and Brian has a more kind of traditional board and chairman at Hamilton. So that was probably then, so obviously at Hibs I have Graham Marty in the same role as Tony Ashcar at Dundee United, so my communication with Graham is daily, both during this period and in a normal working week as well. But I've had different experiences of it. I had, you know, a job at Sunderland where we had nobody between me and the owner, or the directors, if you like, and none of them had a real involvement in the day-to-day running of the club. So I think you have to be prepared to assess what the situation is the club you're at and decide what the best course of action from your point of view is. And I think maybe Robbie's mentioned it there about his experience at MK Dons. It's probably just having that year's consistency, your behaviours through it as well, I think is important, because the one thing you'll find from owners is that their consistency of behaviours is maybe not always that great, because their want to communicate with you or the regularity of communication can change depending upon results, and it's probably the worst thing you can do in any relationship, because immediately that probably builds a mistrust. And it's not, Robbie's mentioned about it being a really important relationship at the club. It's not an easy one to automatically build up. You know, I think it's one that can take time unless you have a previous relationship. But it's certainly one that, if you get right, can be hugely beneficial to the football club as a whole, but certainly your position as manager, as head coach, because you are going to undoubtedly have some sticky periods or difficult periods in your role. And if you've got a positive relationship with the person immediately above you, I think it helps you have, I don't mean a degree of protection, I just think it helps you have a more balanced sustainability in the role as well.
Guys, we're just coming into the kind of last 10 minutes, so last couple of questions. I'll stick with you, Jack. It's another one from one of your players that I quite like, but, you know, Darren McGregor, maybe thinking about, you know, that transition from being a player into manager. I know there is a few players on this course. So how does winning or defeat as a manager differ from winning or losing as a player? Does it hurt more?
I think it'd be wrong to say it hurts any more or any less, because I think if you have played, I think you maybe forget how much it did sting. I think how long the pain lasts for, or the enjoyment lasts for, is very different. So I think the pain of defeat lasts an awful lot longer as a manager, and the joy of winning lasts an awful lot shorter, because when you've won, you know, it's probably an element of relief, and then you start to plan towards the next challenge. When you lose, I think you automatically question and feel responsible for everything that's happened. And then, like, the biggest challenges to overcome and make peace with is that, I think Robbie alluded to this earlier, is once the game starts, aside from some in-game changes you can make, you're really at the behest of your players in terms of what happens, and fortune and good luck and key moments within the games as well. So, yeah, it's different. It is a different feeling, and I think it's probably one that's more all-consuming. You know, I hope Robbie and Brian would agree that I think you can't really escape from the negative feeling, and say the positive feeling probably, unfortunately, doesn't last as long as you would like it to.
You'd agree with that, Robbie? I take it that kind of hurts more in defeat or lasts longer, but maybe you don't get as much time to enjoy a win either as a manager.
Yeah, I think as a player, you know, everyone who's played the game will agree, you could get beat 4-3 and score a hat-trick and you feel, I've done my job. Uh-huh. Because when you're a manager, if the team gets beat, you feel the sole responsibility for it. You know, you're the one that has to You're the one that's put them out there. You're the one that they're playing for. You, they're playing for the club, and you have to take that in the chin. It does it. It stings a lot harder, I've found, as a manager, you know, and it lasts longer because you don't have that opportunity to change it right away. You have to wait till the next week. You have to build everyone back up again. So, you know, I feel that it, depending on what position you're in the league, it could be, you know, the win is just a relief. We've been in that situation before where you just, you know, you win the game, you go, thank God for that, on to the next one. You know, there have been situations where there's elation from it as well. So it's a far more difficult position to be in because you have real highs and lows of it. There has been a manager, there's a player, sometimes you can just look at yourself and go, well, I did all right. There's a manager that they're going out there to do it for you, and it's totally different. So you have found it a huge difference.
To come any easier, Brian, or more difficult, the more experienced you become. And, you know, I know you've probably got a majority of younger players as well. Does that become an added pressure to move through tough times? And, you know, you've maybe went to run a couple of bad defeats.
Yeah, I think when you've got a young team, you know, it's trying to keep their heads up. You shoulder a responsibility. I've always said that when we win, it's the team that's won. But when we've got beat, it's me that's got beat. I picked the team, I picked the tactics. Jack's right. The elation of winning, it's fantastic. But it only lasts a very short period of time where the defeat's in your head. I think the thing that we need to talk about is the criticism you receive when you lose. As a player, you played, you got beat, the gaffer would have a blast at you, whatever. As a manager or a coach, you're questioned. Your question for the supporters, your question for the people above you, and now the media, you know, the TV programmes, the question your tactics, your substitutions, you know, it's very much a personal thing against you. They don't question what the team was doing, it's what was the manager doing, why did they not do this, why did they not do that? So I think that the emphasis is on, you know, yourself being able to not get too high when you win, and don't get too low when you get beat. You know, that, the second bit's the hardest bit to achieve, because that drive home on a Saturday night, as Jack's alluded, he's got a long drive now. When you get beaten a Saturday and you're in your car and your own driving home, you know, it's the worst feeling in the world. It really is. Everything goes through your head. What happened there? What did I do wrong? What am I going to do next week? You're picking teams in your head. And you're, he'll no play again. That one will no play again. And come Monday morning, things become a little bit clearer, but it's still in your head. You know, I found a good way of doing it is coming in and not doing anything Saturday night, Sunday morning, getting up and just writing the positives. Even if we took a hammering, writing the positives down and just reading them two or three times during the day. I need to remember that. We've done that well. Yeah, we got beat, but we've done that well. And it's, you know, it's really, really difficult getting a balance there.
Yeah. Let's try and get some positives just for the last 5 minutes or so. Is there any coach, stick with you, Brian, question from Mark Shields, was there any coach from your playing career that you took an awful lot from? Is there anybody that jumps up? Is Brian Clough an obvious one for you?
Well, there's two. Two I'd like to talk about. Brian Clough. Brian Clough, to me, was a genius. You know, he didn't have the best players in the world, but he had a system, and he fitted players into his system, and he made everything simple. We knew the basics, we knew the principles. 4-4-2, wide areas, cross at front post. Throw ins, don't throw it back the way. Just simple, basic setup. We all knew a role. But then I worked with a man in Qatar called Laszlo Baloni, who's a Romanian internationalist who's managed many, many top teams. Played 100-odd times for Romania. And he was the coach of Sport in Lisbon. When he gave Ronaldo his debut at Sport in Lisbon. And I used to watch him working every night in Qatar, and I worked with him for 2 years, and just seeing the level of detail that he went into was incredible. His sessions he put on, always based on how his team were going to play on the Saturday. Mm-hmm. Always. You know, there was no wee fun nights or anything like that. Very much an Eastern European way of working. And I used to question him all the time, and his English wasn't brilliant, but I got enough out of him. And I go home at night and I'd write every session down. Every session down I'd write. I had time to do it, to be fair. I wrote it down and what I liked and what I didn't like, what I would add to it. And I just felt as though what I learned there has helped me on my journey.
Yeah. I think Jack will say Brian Rice now. He's got to, hasn't he?
I've got to, yeah. Hey, you know, Greg, it's funny because I think I did look at coaches and managers separately when I was playing. So you get asked this question a lot, and there was no real manager that when I was playing that I worked under that, you know, I thought I wanted to be like that or that's who I want to manage. And but from a coaching point of view, and I'm not just saying it because Brian's on. Brian was a terrifically talented coach, and you know, when I was played under him, he was just a manager at the club I was at. A lot of players would tell you the same, and I think he probably helped influence a lot of my early coaching practices. And so I think you can recognise the strengths in another coach and take things from them. I think in terms of management, I suppose I had more ideas about how I would manage and how I would communicate and the consistency in my communication with players. And I maybe felt as if that lacked a little bit when I was a player. And whether or not that's improved as a whole, I think it probably has through the game. I think managers do communicate more openly with players. And I think it was it maybe Gregor Townsend spoke in the pro licence at one point about his own management journey being shaped as much by the managers that he didn't want to be like as much as the ones he did want to be like. So, you know, that's maybe something for people to consider as well, is you can learn and have your own method shaped just as much by some of the managers you didn't enjoy working under as those that you did. But yeah, that's a long answer to saying Brian was the best one.
Brian's the best. What about yourself, Robbie? That coach or player that you've maybe taken, or sorry, coach or manager you've taken along, or is it the same as Jack, where it's bits and bobs from different people?
Over the years, I've been lucky to work under a lot of kind of really good managers, Walter Smith, Alec McLeish, Nigel Pearson, Sven Goran Eriksson. I think I've also had some really bad ones through my career as well, and I do think you learn a lot from both sides of it, how you would like to do things and how you definitely wouldn't do other things. Probably the two that are at two different ends of the scale, but with two real top managers that I worked with. The first one would probably be Nigel Pearson. Nigel was a leader. Nigel got everyone behind him. He was at the front of the queue, first one out there, driving everyone forward, and everyone believed in him just by the way he carried himself and his belief. And then the other one at the other end of the scale was Sven Goran Eriksson, who was very much behind everyone, helping people become the best they could be, allowing the coaches to coach, great in his man management skills. When I was there, I played underneath him, like I hardly ever played, but every Friday he would speak to the players that weren't playing, and he would get into his office and he would tell you weren't playing, but you came out the office after he'd spoken to you thinking you were the best player in the world and you were definitely going to play the next Friday, just the way he managed and the way he spoke to people. So it was two different characters that have been at the top of or are at the top of the game. Just it showed me how there's different ways to lead. You don't have to be the big, hard, aggressive leader all the time. You don't need to be the one that's behind just helping people through it. You can change your leadership style as need be.
Yeah. Fantastic. Guys, just to wrap up then, just I'll maybe go around the three of you for a one-liner just on advice to the guys on the course. There's a few questions in, like, you know, young aspiring coaches, what kind of advice would you give them, you know, looking back in your own careers or how you want to kick on, even in your own career? What advice, Brian, would you give those on the course just now?
Keep willing to learn. Ask experienced coaches. Go and watch people coaching and define the difference between training and coaching, because they're a massive difference. You know, have variations to your sessions. You know, you need to keep motivating the players. I think we spoke about it this morning. You're a teacher. You need to teach. So for me, don't be afraid to delegate either. That's massive. But keep pushing yourself. As soon as you're in the comfort zone, you're standing still. Keep aiming for the top.
Fantastic. Jack, we'll come to you with that one, if you don't mind.
I think given, obviously, I know that there's a kind of wide range of participants, Greg, across this course and what their ambitions might be. And I think that, maybe alluded to this earlier on, we're speaking about assistant managers, is recognising what your strengths are and you know, being aware of them and then using them in the best possible way. Don't be seduced by the fact that you may believe that being a manager is the sexiest part of the game or the one that has the most kudos or whatever it might be. If that's not where your strengths lie, then go and be the best head analyst or go and be the best assistant manager or the best goalkeeping coach, whatever it might be. And then I think beyond that is, like probably in alignment with what Brian said, is be creative and bold with what you do. You have that bravery to do it. If it doesn't work, that can be an individual session. It can be an all-round approach. I think don't be afraid to do that and recognise the bits that don't work and have faith in the bits that do.
Fantastic. Robbie, closing remarks on that one for you?
Yeah, I would say, you know, something I say a lot to the players and my staff is like, don't try to be the next, you know, Mourinho or Guardiola or Klopp. You know, be the first you, be the, somebody different, try something different, because somewhere there is somebody who's working on some different styles or different tactics, and in 5 years' time, they're going to be the one that everyone's copying. Because at the moment, if you're trying to be like these managers just now, your Guardiolas, your Klopps, you're behind the future. You know, you're trying to be something that's going to be out of date in 5 years' time. You look at Mourinho as a periodisation. Everyone started doing that. And then Guardiola looking at the positional play, everyone started doing that. And now Klopp's in with the pressing and the counter-pressing. Now everyone's starting to do that. Somebody's out there and they're going to be doing something different. So it might be someone on this course that's doing it. So I would say try and be the next you. Don't just be following everyone else.
Yeah. Guys, fantastic stuff. I'm sure I joined the other, what have we got, other 97 participants and saying a huge thanks for giving up that time there and giving us your wisdom and your thoughts on that. So absolutely fantastic stuff.